For a few moments this evening, I want to talk to you from one of my favorite Old Testament prophets, the prophet Daniel. I'll direct your attention to a scripture passage that I'm going to look at. But before I do, just a little bit of background for this great book. The southern kingdom, Judah, the last remaining 12 tribes of Israel, Judah and little Dan, two tribes of the original 12, are the lone remaining survivors of what was once the 12 tribes of Israel. They are caught in the midst of international crisis. They are caught in the midst of competing armies. If you can visualize the Middle East tonight, the map of it in your mind, you'll notice the Mediterranean Sea and then the Jordan River, and in between is Palestine. Running through Palestine is called the King's Highway. It was called that because kings from Egypt, from Assyria, from Babylon would be marching up and down this highway, often in battle. And here was little southern kingdom, Judah and Dan, caught in the midst of international crisis. The book of Daniel is in the time frame of about 603 BC. 605, there was a battle at a place called Carchemish. The Babylonian army and the Egyptian army fought there. It was a great skirmish. It was a defining moment in Israel's history. Egypt was defeated, and the prevailing world power from 605 BC onward was the Neo-Babylonian Empire, under the head of General Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to consolidate his new found victory. He wanted to put down all skirmishes. He wanted to eliminate all rivals. And so he was very interested in the activity on the King's Highway. Jeremiah the prophet did his best. In fact, he is the last prophet before the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC. Jeremiah did his best to convince the people from 605 BC on, learn to live with the Babylonian people. Submit to the Babylonians, and you will live. That was his message. There was a prophet in the land by the name of Hananiah. Hananiah's message was this: people of the land, if we will join forces with Egypt, together we can fight Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylonian army and prevail. And unfortunately, the people listened to Hananiah, the false prophet, to their everlasting doom. Well, 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army, the kingdom of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, is the world power of the day. Every now and then, Nebuchadnezzar would come down the king's highway just to check on Judah and Dan, the southern kingdom. On each occasion, these are called deportations, by the way. On each occasion, a king might be taken away, maybe a queen, some of the royal family, some of the prize gold and silver instruments from the temple might be taken away as captive, captured and taken back. And sometime some of the prize young men of the territory would be taken back. That's how Daniel ends up over in Babylon. On one of these deportations, he was taken as prisoner of war. He is now in Babylon. And the book of Daniel begins around 603 BC, the second year of the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, a proud man, a victorious general, world fame. But Nebuchadnezzar was eaten alive almost, gnawing at him night after night, a dream that he couldn't figure out. He kept having this dream. It haunted him. We say today, if mom's not happy, nobody's happy. Well, before that, if the king's not happy, nobody's happy. The land was in turmoil. The court, the government was in turmoil. The king is in turmoil. Well, what do you do? Remember a few years ago? What do you do? You call Ghostbusters. What do you do? They called in the conjurers, the magicians, the wise men of the land. This is who the king depended on. These were the wise men who answered all the difficult questions. And the king laid this proposition before them. Two things. Number one, tell me my dream. And number two, interpret it. He knew if I tell them the dream just to save their own neck, they'd make up anything. So tell me the dream and then interpret it for me. There's not possibility of doing this, chapter 2 says. We can't do this. No king has ever asked people to do this. It's impossible. Until somebody said, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, the word is one of these Hebrew youth. And Daniel was about 17 or 18 when he was taken as prisoner of war over in Babylon. One of these youth, the word is he is endowed with an unusual gift of interpretation, of understanding. Let's give him a try. Nebuchadnezzar calls in young Daniel, lays out the proposition. A great statement in Daniel chapter 2. We don't have time really to look at it. Daniel says, I have nothing in and of myself. I have no special gift, but there is a God in heaven, and he gives me information. I don't know it. It's not me. But there is a God in heaven. And Nebuchadnezzar, I'll be back to give you not only your dream, but the interpretation. Well, very quickly, here's the dream. Night after night, Nebuchadnezzar had this dream. A 90-foot statue, 9 feet wide, 90 feet high. You can barely imagine it standing on a 9-foot wide base. But here is this humongous statue. Head of gold. Chest of silver. Waist of bronze. Legs of lead and feet of lead and stone. What in the world can this mean? Daniel came back, told him the dream, outlined the statue, and said, here's what it means. You, Nebuchadnezzar, and your kingdom, you are the head of gold. The Neo-Babylonian Empire, its wealth, its structure, its beautiful gardens, its military might, the world looks to Nebuchadnezzar and to Babylon. You are the head of gold. But you aren't going to last forever. You will be succeeded by a silver breast representing the Medo-Persian Empire. This would be Cyrus the Great. And the Persian Empire would be succeeded by a waist of bronze. That would be the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great. The legs of iron, the Roman Empire. And so we have four civilizations extending from 605 BC up into the time of Christ. Neo-Babylonian Empire, Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire. This made Daniel a man to reckon with in the Neo-Babylonian government, much to the chagrin of the conjurers and the magicians and the soothsayers. Here was this kid who can do it, and we can't. It made Daniel a reputation in the land of Babylon. But now we turn to Daniel chapter 5. That's where I want to begin reading. And I want to speak to you just for a few minutes tonight on the handwriting on the wall. The handwriting on the wall. Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar, the king. So we know right away we have passed from Nebuchadnezzar, his reign, now to succeeding kings and emperors and court intrigue. And now we're down to a man called Belshazzar. Dr. O.D. Lovell, a name that some of you may recognize. Dr. Lovell taught at Malone College, Bethel College, ended his career at Circleville Bible College in the 80s. Dr. O.D. Lovell entitled this chapter, Belshazzar, Babylonian's Bad Boy. Belshazzar is now the king. Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. He was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wife and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, pardon me, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. The king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale. His thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. Verse 6 is quite a description of a man finding the handwriting on the wall. The king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom." Now we are a long way, distance-wise, from Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel, with his reputation of interpreting the king's dream. In fact, Daniel might be in semi-retirement. Forgotten. He's been put on the shelf. But the queen remembers him. "There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is a spirit of holy gods. And in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an excellent spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanations of enigmas, solving the difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation." We have come a long way in this very quick survey of the first five chapters of Daniel, from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar. We have come a distance from 603 BC. This is now 539 BC. As the end of the chapter is going to indicate, chapter 5, on this very night, the kingdom was taken away from Belshazzar and given to the Medo-Persians. This is the end. This is the last night of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Handwriting is on the wall. This is the last night of this great empire. We've come a long way. Nebuchadnezzar, a tyrant, a general, ruthless, demanding, but yet had some respect. If we take the gold and silver instruments from the temple in Jerusalem, we at least have enough respect to put them in a safe place over here in Babylon. We at least have enough respect for the things of the Hebrew religion. but not this man, Belshazzar. A little bit of wine emboldens him and says, bring out those temple vessels from Jerusalem. And we end up with a wild orgy, a drunken orgy, the last night of the Babylonian Empire. In the midst of this wild scene, did you notice the hedonism, the secularism of verse 4? They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, stone. That was their object of worship. That's how secular they were. Brazen. Drunken. Out of control. And in the midst of this night of revelry, a hand appears opposite Belshazzar. Now, this is probably going to be a figure of speech, part equals whole, hand, arm, person of God, writing the doom of this pagan, secular, neo-Babylonian empire. But we just see the hand. And the fingers are writing words. Belshazzar, he cannot interpret them. Finally, the queen says, bring in Daniel. Well, the handwriting is on the wall. And here is what the handwriting says. Verse 25. Verse 26. This is the interpretation of the handwriting. First, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Daniel has been put in semi-retirement. But that doesn't mean God doesn't know what's going on in Babylon. That doesn't mean God is not aware of the secularism, of the drunkenness, of the orgy, of the sinfulness that is going on in the land of Babylon. God has numbered your kingdom, put an end to it. Number two, the word says, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. In fact, you aren't even moving the needle. That's how bad this is. Your kingdom is coming to an end. You, your life, King, your life is worthless. When you weigh it out on the scales of worth, you don't even move the needle. And finally, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. And verse 30, that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. Darius the Mede received the kingdom. He was about age 62. 539 BC. One kingdom falls, another one takes its place. Now, it just didn't happen one night. What happened in Babylon is a slow but sure drift. Day by day, season by season, change in leadership by change in leadership, until finally the land is under the control of a drunken tyrant who can't even move the scale of moral worth. But the handwriting could have been seen long ago if people had perception. Someone in the kingdom should have said, you know, things aren't going right. We're not on the right track. Even as a nation, Neo-Babylonian, we're not where we should be. We aren't where we once were. Somebody should have been able to see certain signs. Until one night, the handwriting was on the wall. Well, whenever you teach the book of Daniel, this makes an interesting history section, and students are usually interested in this. But let's fast forward to the 21st century just for a few minutes. I'm going to quickly outline for you my interpretation of the United States of America in my lifetime. I begin with what Thomas Brokaw referred to as the greatest generation. If you read his book, you know what he has reference to. An army, a force that saved the world, not only in Europe, but in the Pacific. Someone said just recently, if you can read a certain statement, thank a teacher. If you can read it in English, thank a veteran. The greatest generation. And if you think about the end of the Second World War, and trust me, I'm going on what I've read. I don't exactly have that firsthand knowledge of it. But Second World War, we not only defeated a tyrant in Europe and saved Europe for democracy, but then we turned around and fed them the Marshall Plan that kept much of Europe alive, 47 and 48, the greatest generation had ever lived. We moved too quickly into the 1950s and the Vietnam era, a country that had just gone through a Second World War, had no intention of fighting another battle. And that ended in, at best, a stalemate. At best. We go into the 60s. And now we have a Vietnam conflict. And I'm not even sure historians would call that. We just evened out. I'm not sure we would call that. It certainly wasn't a victory. And then we moved into the 70s. Let's make love, not war. Who needs values? Who needs morality? And we had a whole cultural rebellion in the 70s. In the 80s and the 90s, we are in and out of the Middle East and Afghanistan. Finally, in the 21st century, we have 9/11. And in 2008, we have a financial crisis that is probably only second to the Great Depression in the 1930s. We may not still have recovered from it. May I suggest to you that as a country, as a nation, the handwriting has been on the wall. Now, for the next 5 or 6 minutes, this is not political. In fact, I am ordained by a denomination that is founded on what they call the six cardinal principles, and one of them is no partisan political preaching. And I happen to agree with that. But this is not political. This is, are we able to see the handwriting on the wall? That's the question. It's not a question of politics. It's a question of, are we alert? It's a question of, are we seeing what's going on around us? Just as there were people in the Babylonian Empire who, if they were sharp enough, and if they had the nerve enough, and if they would have spoken up, perhaps they could have sounded words of alarm. So in our day, who or what group will stand up and say, we see handwriting on the wall, and it's not good for our country? There was I don't see it much anymore, but there was a time when it was sort of fashionable to wear on a bracelet, WWJD, question mark. What would Jesus do? A good question, and a question that I believe many people took very seriously. It's too late now. I've missed the market, but I thought of a bracelet for 2016. HWJV. How would Jesus vote? Now, I've missed the market. I know. We barely got t-shirts printed and for sale. I know the bracelets aren't going to go. But I've come to two conclusions. How would Jesus vote? Number one, he would vote. He would. And you know, it's a shocking statistic when we discover how many evangelicals chose not to vote in 2012. And if some are right, it's even looking worse in 2016 among the evangelical voter. I believe if Jesus of Nazareth was walking the streets of Atlanta this day and was going to be alive, I believe he would vote. He would render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. But I believe, number two, as in every other decision he made, he would pray to his heavenly Father and say, not my will, but thine be done. Now, this is not political, but I'm saying, handwriting is on the wall. We just can't walk into a voting booth and say, Grandpa would roll over in the grave if I didn't vote like he did. There may have been a day when that could be. I think we're past that. I think we're too desperate for that. And this is not a statement about the value and importance of the American Union. But I do tell you this. We cannot walk into a voting booth and just say, how does my union want me to vote? If we're Christian, we're going to vote, but we're going to spend time in prayer asking, how would Jesus vote for the sake of our country? I'm suggesting to you the handwriting is on the wall. LCA. LCA. I see it. Last chance, America. LCA. Every election is important, but I suggest to you the election of 2016 is probably the most important election you and I will face in our lifetime. If nothing else, because at least one, and looking at the age of other Supreme Court members, several could be replaced and put into a lifetime position. This is not the time for the church just to sit back and say, I'm upset. My candidate didn't get, I'm not going to vote. Somebody, some group, has got to stand up and say, the handwriting is on the wall, and as a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ, I'm going to do my dead level best to respond and stand in the gap for the sake of this country. I didn't necessarily expect that, but a wise man would say, sit down. But I do have a couple other things to say. This may be my only time to get to say it. When you think from the greatest generation, I would suggest America in the late 40s could have been the best loved nation around the world. We saved the world for democracy. I would tell you tonight, I think we are one of the most hated nations in the world. I've heard my general superintendent, Dr. Tom, tell us three reasons why. My general superintendent says he believes America is hated, number one, because we are a Christian nation. Historically, that is true. I'm not sure whether that's so true anymore. We may, as some have suggested, be a post-Christian society. But Tom Hermes has said, we're hated because, at least historically, we were a Christian nation. Number two, we are hated because we stand alongside of Israel and support that nation. And I think, again, that may be wavering on some fronts, but historically that has been true. We have stood side by side this little nation. And then he says there's a third reason. That America is hated around the world, in his judgment at least. And he says it's because of the culture, the low morality that is often presented as America. And the Christian church needs to say, right on. Right on. We ought to be angry about the moral direction of this country. We ought to be upset. We ought to be upset enough to say, enough is enough. Well, the handwriting is on the wall. The question remains, what will be the end result? I believe in a God of the second, the third, and the fourth chance. I would suggest that the hope for America tonight is a fourth great awakening of revival from coast to coast, across the length and breadth of this land, My friend, that is our only hope of escaping the handwriting on the wall. Doesn't take the majority. It doesn't take a consensus of majority of opinion. It takes men and women like you and I who will say, with God as our helper, with God as our helper, we will stand in the gap and pray and believe that God still wants to bless America once again. God bless America once again.